Welcome back to the Old History Podcast, historians from around the internet. So, last weekend I got to do something really cool. I was super excited to do it, and I've been wanting to go into there for a long time. So, the owner of Hayslope and I are we talk a lot. I help her out with some things that needs done, and she asks for my opinion, and we just help each other out because she's trying to restore Hayslope to its original log cabin splendor, and it's super cool. Hayslope is a very neat place, and I honestly need to make a podcast just about Hayslope, but fact of the matter, the house deserves at least 3 books. You could talk and talk and talk about the history of Hayslope, and she is an authority on the history. She's already came out with 1 book, and she's got a website up, hayslope.org, where you can donate to her cause. And she's got all kinds of information on there. It's just super, super cool. Anyway, we crawled under the cabin, under the house, because her renters had got out, and she was like, go under there, do whatever you want to do. And so, well, we did. We went into there, searched for some relics, see, you know, because stuff does fall through the floor of the older cabins, because the floors, you know, they just slapped them down. They were just made as a house to live in. But anyway, we didn't really find much in the way of relics, but we found stuff, just not old relics, is what I'm trying to say. We got to see what I was more interested in, apart from the relics, was seeing the state of the original logs. And some of the timbers had some extensive termite damage. One of them was split in half. But outside of that, the chimney and stuff, both of the fireplaces, the brick was still in outstanding shape. So, super, super cool. I did make a video on that. It's titled Relic Hunting Underneath a 240-Year-Old Log Cabin. You can find that on the Old History Project YouTube channel. Also, special announcement, we just crossed 1,600 subscribers on the YouTube channel. 1,610 specifically. Alright, so other than that, no news. So let's take a quick break, and we'll talk about some more of the Civil War. Alright, so Civil War stuff. There is a lot to talk about in the Civil War. Lots of political hoo-ha to talk about. So in the last podcast, we talked about John Brown's raid and the beginning of the Civil War. Now, we're not getting in too deep into this because this could go a thousand different ways. So we're just talking like a general overview of the Civil War. This is meant to be spread out over a long time, because, you know, hearing about all this stuff in Tennessee, it does get old. And the goal here is to just talk about history. So from just a rough timeline of the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln is elected November 6, 1860. In December, and January, 6 states would secede from the Union, South Carolina being the first. Tennessee being the very last state to secede from the Union. By March 4th, Abraham Lincoln would be inaugurated officially as president. And then shortly after that, in April, would be when the Battle of Fort Sumter began. You know, the shot heard around the world, the very first battle of the Civil War. So after Fort Sumter, President Lincoln would issue a public declaration that an insurrection existed, and he called for 75,000 militia to help stop the rebellion. And as a result of this call for volunteers, 4 additional southern states would secede from the Union in the following weeks. Lincoln responded on May the 3rd with an additional call for 43,000 plus volunteers to serve for 3 years, expanding the size of the regular army. Union forces would cross the Potomac and occupy Arlington Heights, which would be the home of future Confederate General Robert Lee. It is during this occupation of nearby Alexandria that Colonel Elmer Ellsworth, of commander of the 11th New York Infantry and a close friend of the Lincolns, is shot dead by the owner of the Marshall House just after removing a Confederate flag from its roof. So, and then we're getting into the first actual big battle of the first land battle of the Civil War. But before we do, let's talk real quickly about the Civil War, the secession of Tennessee from the Union. So, as I said earlier, Tennessee was the first to secede from the Union and the first readmitted back to the Union after the war ended. So, Tennessee seceded when the Civil War entered its third month. Tennessee, which was a border state poised between the North and South, voted 172 to 47,328 to secede from the Union and join the Confederacy. The state's mountainous eastern section, you know, over here in East Tennessee, not a lot of people owned slaves. I mean, they were here, but that they weren't, how am I trying to say this? They weren't, there wasn't a lot of slaves. There weren't, it wasn't a very populous region for slaves because, I mean, there's rocks everywhere up here. It's very hilly, and it's hard to successfully farm anything up here on a large scale. The more prominent families up here would have slaves, but of course, like the statesmen and the people that got bukus and bukus of land for their service in the Revolution. But as far as like the common person just coming up here, they didn't have no slaves. So they voted, they actually opposed secession, and they wanted to stay up here. They wanted to stay with the Union. During the war, many Tennesseans wore gray Confederate Union uniforms, while others donned Union blue. It furnished more soldiers for the Confederate Army than any other state, and more soldiers for the Union Army than any other southern state. So, by February 1862, with the aid of naval forces, General Grant seized control of the Cumberland and Tennessee rivers. By April, Union troops held off a bloody Confederate counterattack at Shiloh. Memphis, Tennessee would fall to the Union in June following a naval battle on the Mississippi River. Andrew Johnson, future President Johnson and a Southern Democrat who broke with his party over secession, was from East Tennessee. He was from Greenville. Actually, no, he was from Jonesboro. In May 1862, President Lincoln named Johnson the military governor of those parts of the state under federal control. After the war, delegates from all across the state met in Nashville to shape a new state constitution. It would be adopted February 23, 1870, and because Tennessee had ratified the 14th Amendment, it was the only secessionist state that did not have a military governor from Washington during the Reconstruction. And so that's just a little quick history on Tennessee during the Civil War. We'll get more into that a little later. So then we got to talk about the Battle of Bull Run, or Big Bethel. But first, we're going to take us a quick break. All right, so the Battle of Big Bethel. It is considered by many historians to be the first major land engagement of the Civil War. The Battle of Big Bethel was fought on June 10th, 1861, at the southern end of the Virginia Peninsula. Statewide, on April 17th, 1861, a statewide convention of Virginia delegates passed an ordinance of secession declaring the state's intention to leave the Union subject to ratification by the general electorate in a poll scheduled for May 23rd, 1861. As most Virginians prepared to cast their ballots, the United States government began reinforcing Fort Monroe between the James and the York Rivers at the tip of the Virginia Peninsula. The day before voters approved ordinance of secession, Union General Benjamin Butler took command of the growing garrison at the strategically important stronghold. As the size of Butler's garrison grew too large, to subsist within the port, he established fortified outposts named Camp Hamilton, Camp Butler, at the nearby villages of Hampton and Newport News. So the first clash at Big Bethel, as the 7th New York Infantry Regiment arrived at their position, the 3rd New York Infantry Regiment, dressed in gray uniforms, came up behind them. Fearing that Confederates were at the rear, the 7th New York opened up on the 3rd New York, killing 2 Union soldiers and wounding 19 others before the firing stopped. Spooked by the firing on their left, the 5th New York withdrew. Making matters even worse, the friendly fire between Union forces alerted Magruder to their presence, eliminating any possibility of surprise. Now, I'm getting ahead of myself, but Winthrop's plan, when Butler learned of Magruder's movements, he ordered Major Theodore Winthrop to devise a plan to drive the Virginians back up the peninsula. Winthrop's plan called for 2 columns under the overall command of Brigadier General Ebenezer W. Pierce to depart from Camp Hamilton and Monroe and to converge on Little Bethel during the night of June 9th and the 10th. From there, they would rendezvous with the 3rd column comprising of the 5th New York Infantry Regiment and move on to Big Bethel. So while the Federals tried to get themselves reorganized, the Virginians at Little Bethel fell back to the defensive works at Big Bethel. After regrouping, the Yankees resumed their march on Big Bethel. Magruder's forces easily repulsed several direct assaults, sending the Federals fleeing back to Fort Monroe by early afternoon. So, this one wasn't even a big battle compared to what would come in the next few months, the next few years even. The Southerners would celebrate it as a glorious victory, but also a harbinger of what was to be expected in a very short war. The rebels suffered only 8 casualties, 1 killed and 7 wounded. Among nearly 1,400 soldiers engaged, the lone soldier killed was Private Henry Lawson Wyatt of North Carolina, who has the distinction of being the first Confederate enlisted man to be killed during the Civil War. The Federals suffered 76 casualties, 18 killed and 53 wounded, and 5 missing. There were around about 3,500 soldiers engaged, and members of Congress would go on to criticize Butler for not personally leading the operation. So, the next thing to talk about would be the Battle of First Manassas, depending on who you talk to. It's called the Battle of Bull Run. So, the Battle of First Manassas is what it was called whenever I was taught about it. General Irvin McDowell's army of 35,000 men marched out to begin the long-awaited campaign to capture Richmond at the end of the war. It was an army of green recruits, few of whom had the faintest idea of the magnitude of what they were actually walking into. So, as excitement spread, many citizens and congressmen, with wine and picnic baskets, followed the army into the field to watch what all expected to be a colorful show. The troops were 90-day volunteers summoned by President Abraham Lincoln after the startling news of Fort Sumter burst over the nation in April of that year, 1861. They were from shops and farms and blacksmith shops, libraries, and they didn't know what a war even was. They didn't know what it would mean. And the first day's march covered only 5 miles, as many straggled back to pick blackberries or fill up the canteens. General McDowell's lumbering columns were headed for the vital railroad junction at Manassas. Here, the Orange and Alexandria Railroad met the Manassas Gap Railroad. I cannot talk today. And then that went west to the Shenandoah Valley. If McDowell could seize this junction, He would stand astride to the best overland approach to the Confederate capital. On July the 18th, McDowell's army reached Centerville. 5 miles ahead, a small meandering stream named Bull Run crossed the route of the Union advance. And there, guarding the fords from Union Mills to the Stone Bridge, waited 22,000 Southern troops under the command of General Pierre Gustave Beauregard. General P.G.T. Beauregard is who you'll see him referred to as in other media, other forms of reading. So, McDowell first attempted to move towards the Confederate right flank, but his troops were checked at Blackburn's Ford. He spent the next 2 days scouting the southern left flank. In the meantime, Beauregard asked the Confederate government at Richmond for help. General Joseph Johnston, stationed at the Shenandoah Valley with 10,000 Confederate troops, was ordered to support Beauregard if possible. Johnston, he basically gave an opposing Union army the slip, and employing the Manassas Gap Railroad, started his brigades towards Manassas Junction. Most of Johnston's troops arrived at the junction on July 20th and 21st, and some marching directly right into battle. The morning of July 21st, McDowell would send his attack columns in a large march north towards Sedley Springs Ford. This route took the Federals around the Confederate left to distract the Southerners, and McDowell would order a divisionary attack where the Warrington Turnpike crossed Bull Run at the Stone Bridge. At 5:30 in the a.m., a deep-throated roar of a 30-pounder Patriot rifle shattered the morning calm and signaled the start of the battle. Basically, his new plan depended on surprising speed and surprise, both difficult with inexperienced troops. Valuable time would be lost as the men stumbled through the darkness along narrow roads. Confederate Colonel Nathan Evans, who was commanding at the Stone Bridge, soon realized that the attack on his front was only a diversion, leaving a small force to hold the bridge. Evans rushed the remainder of his command to Matthews Hill in time to check McDowell's lead, but Evans' force was too small to hold the Federals back for any amount of time. The brigades under Bernard Bee and Francis Bartow marched to Evans' assistance, but even these reinforcements, the thin gray line, collapsed, and the Southerners fled in disarray towards Henry Hill. Attempting to rally his men, Bee would use General Thomas Jackson's newly arrived brigade as an anchor. Pointing to Jackson, Bee shouted, "There stands Jackson like a stone. Rally behind the Virginians." Generals Johnson and Beauregard then arrived on Henry Hill, where they assisted in rallying the shattered brigades and redeploying fresh units that were marching to the point of danger. Around noon, the Federals stopped their advance to reorganize for a new attack. This lasted for only about an hour and gave the Confederates enough time to reform their lines, and then the fighting resumed. With each side trying to force the other off the hill, the battle continued until just after 4 p.m., when fresh Southern units crashed into the Union right flank on Chin Ridge, causing McDowell's tired and discouraged and inexperienced troops to withdraw. After the first withdrawal was orderly, screened by the regulars, the 3 month volunteers retired across Bull Run, where they found the road to Washington jammed with the carriages of congressmen and the others who had driven out to Centerville to watch the fight. Panic now seized many of the soldiers, and the retreat became a rout. The Confederates, bolstered by the arrival of President Jefferson Davis on the field, just as the battle was ending, were too disorganized to follow up on their success. So, this is just a rundown of two of the very first major battles of the Civil War. So, I hope you guys enjoy them. Thanks for listening. See you guys next time.